I think that meditation practice has a lot to offer people, but when people live in a urban environment with households and work and things like that, sometimes it can be hard to sustain meditation practice. And some people are challenged to find the time or all that. I just came back from spending 5 days at a Zen monastery, and it's easy to get up and meditate there. You know, they ring the bell to wake you up in the morning, and so everything's kind of like all the people are going, and so it's really, in some ways, easy. And aside from meditation practice, sometimes it's difficult to sustain or to nourish a meditation life or a contemplative life or a spiritual life in such a way that not just our meditation life is fostered and continued, but also that somehow the values and the presence, the way of being in the world that meditation might foster is continued into our normal life and becomes seamless, something that influences, affects, benefits the rest of our life, not just something we do in meditation itself. So one of the interesting questions then is, what is it that nourishes a meditative life, a contemplative life? So I want to talk about five nourishments, the five things that nourish this kind of life. And these five things are confidence, engagement, honesty, stability, and deep understanding. So five things that nourish this life. Now there's a lot of other things that nourish this kind of life. When you look at the mind or the heart, the kind of inner spiritual life, it's kind of like an ecosystem. And there's lots and lots of different kind of life forms in this ecosystem, lots of different factors. And all these different factors are mutually influence each other. So if you add one nice thing to it, it changes the whole dynamics of everything else. So you could look at other things as being what nourish a spiritual life, things you underemphasized. But today I want to emphasize these five, and these in turn affect a lot of other things. So confidence, engagement, honesty, stability, and deep understanding. So the first one, confidence. I love the word confidence because then you're confident, or you know, the idea of being confident. Any endeavor that you want to do, you'll do it better with confidence. In fact, I was reading a book to my 8-year-old son about baseball today, and the little teaching there was, when you get up to bat, bat as if you're a great batter already. So the story was a story. So the guy got up there and he took that position. I'm already great. And so he hit the ball. Certainly, all the doubts that we have about ourselves can get in the way. If you have a lot of doubt to hit the ball, you probably won't hit the ball. Doubts are a real drag on us and inhibit many, many activities when doubt is present. But to do something with confidence changes the ecosystem, changes our hearts quite a bit. And to do it as if we already were capable, as if it's worthwhile, as if it's the right time, the right situation, to do it with confidence in what we're going to do. Then we do it with a certain kind of energy, a certain kind of maybe inspiration, a certain kind of, I guess it's a tautology to say we do it with a certain amount of confidence. If we have confidence, we do it with confidence. So to engage with confidence. And in terms of a meditative life, there's a lot of things you could have confidence in. One of the things that you do is have confidence in the meditation practice, that it's worthwhile. Or the spiritual life, or the religious tradition you're part of, that it's worthwhile, it's beneficial, it's good, it's great. You have confidence in yourself. You have confidence that, yes, it's a worthwhile practice, but I can't do it. It's for those great sages of the past, right? And then I'll just sit here and read the books. They're kind of nice to read, but I'm never going to do it because I'm not up to this. Well, it's been said that meditation does not work if you don't do it. So if the doubts keep you from doing it, then you know, it's not going to work. So you have to do it. And so if you're going to do it, then can you do it with confidence? If you're going to do it anyway, then why waste your energy, waste your time doing it with lack of confidence, doubting yourself? And there's a kind of art, I think, to sometimes pretending. So I don't know if it's always good to pretend, but sometimes you pretend when the alternative is worse. So you pretend you can do it. Okay, I can do this. And so then you sit down with a certain level of confidence and assurance and inspiration, perhaps, and kind of, to engage. And so there's a lot of things that can bring confidence. And so people who need confidence, sometimes could go out into the world and find ways to get confident. An indispensable element of my own confidence and my own kind of engagement in practice has been the confidence I got from practicing with other people. And whether it's fellow students or teachers or different things, to actually been around other people who have practiced and seeing what they've done, see how it's affected them, benefited them, gave me a lot of confidence in the practice and really encouraged me. Sometimes I encountered people who were a total psychological mess or emotional mess or something. And it's just, they were just, you know, basket cases or whatever. And then I've seen them practice and engage in their life and practice and practice. And I've seen them over the years change in dramatic ways. And to see this in my fellow practitioners was really inspiring to me. Wow, if that's the result, that's what it is, that's what happens, then, you know, this is something I can have confidence in. I've gotten confidence sometimes from reading spiritual books, Buddhist books, and been so inspired by those teachings that I was just raring to put it into practice. Great, I was on fire. So there was a period of time where I'd read about 2 paragraphs a day in a Buddhist book. That's all I could stand. Well, in the best senses of that word, that expression, that's all I could manage, because I was so inspired and it gave me so much to work on, just these 2 paragraphs. That, okay, well, now I have the rest of the day, I'm going to be busy the rest of the day. I'm engaging in this, doing this kind of practice. So, reading really kind of gave me a boost, these short little spurts that I'd read every day. Something else that's given me a lot of confidence in my practice is seeing the results in myself. And I certainly have sat to meditate sometimes without any confidence. In fact, with lack of confidence, with doubt. Oh, you know, I can't do this, or this is not the right time, or maybe I have the wrong practice, or this is hard, or just some kind of self-defeating kind of attitude in my mind. But somehow I've been engaged in it anyway. Just kept doing it, even with those doubts. And then watching, in spite of my doubts, and watching things start to change. And so I watch myself start to become freer and more present, more concentrated, with a greater sense of joy and happiness. And to watch, there's a natural process in the practice. If you do the practice of mindfulness and show up, and keep showing up, there's a transformation that happens I don't even feel responsible for. And this is one of the great things about this practice I've seen, is the way in which I have to do my part. I have to show up with some quality showing up. But then something happens that I don't feel I can be responsible for. There's a settling, a letting go, a concentrating, an opening, a revealing, a discovering. There's things that start happening. And it's been really important for me to realize that I can't be responsible for some of the more profound things that's going to happen to me in this practice. And that gives me actually a lot of confidence rather than a lack of confidence. It means if I kind of engage in this process, it's almost like a lawful process. It's a natural kind of process that unfolds if I put myself and give it my best. And it's been, I've been doing, living a Buddhist life since my early 20s, kind of really making that my central part of my life, maybe very different than most of you who have other things. But one of the things that has given me a lot of confidence is that major turning points in my life where I had to make some big decision what to do, like should I go to college or go to graduate school or should I go to Buddhist monastery? When I was in Japan, I had to make a decision whether to go get a job, because I only had like, I don't remember how much I had, but it was less than $200. So, you know, that's, when you have that little money in your name, you know, the usual thing to do is try to get a job. So, should I get a job or should I go in the monastery? Should I, you know, what should I do? And I keep making a decision that somehow follows the Dharma, follows the practice. And somehow, miraculously, that always seems to work out. And that's given me a lot of confidence in the practice and engagement in the practice life to watch and see the benefits that have come, how it's worked out so well for me. I feel very lucky that way, very fortunate. So confidence, to sit with confidence, to practice with confidence, to have a confidence. I think part of the reason why I like the word, the concept of confidence, is that confidence to me feels physical. It's not just an idea, but it's something that you can kind of, it's a certain kind of strength that I feel in my chest, in my heart, in my torso. I feel when I have confidence, it's kind of like a vitality that's there available. It's like an availability of energy that's ready to go, ready to do. So confidence is nourishes a spiritual life. The second thing that nourishes a spiritual life is engagement. You got to engage. You got to do it. If you don't do it, it doesn't work. So the engagement part. And I know that sometimes there can be a lot of confidence and a lot of great sense of purpose and no follow through. There's all these other things that have to happen. Sometimes no follow through because everything else seems so important. There's so many important things to do. You know, after all, you have to get the oil changed in your car and the new tires and you have to go shopping and you have to, you know, call your relative who's sick and you have to do this and that. And there's, you know, and then some people have the attitude, well, I'll just get all these things out of the way and then I'll practice. And after a few months, you know, the list gets longer. Or some people have made that choice with big things in their life. Well, I'll get a job, I'll get some savings, I'll have an IRA, I'll have all these things in place, and then I'll engage in a meditation life or a spiritual life. Somehow, there's ways in which we put it off. Maybe some of the putting off is necessary and wise, but it could also be a tremendous delusion to think that you'll get to it. You'll get to it. Because then there'll be something else, another thing standing in the way. So at some point there has to be some decision, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to somehow make the time and engage in this practice. But I like the word engagement because engagement is stronger to me than doing. Engagement means you put yourself in it. A few months ago I taught a retreat with a Vipassana teacher who was also a Zen teacher in a previous incarnation as a teacher. So I had done a lot of Zen practice. And at one point during the retreat, we were both interviewing a man who was having a lot of difficulties with his home life. He'd come for 2 weeks of the month-long retreat. And a lot of the conversations were about his young child, who was 5 or 6, who was somewhat autistic. Very high need, very high demand kid. And this Zen teacher, this teacher I was teaching with, she was a psychologist who worked with kids. So at some point after this man left and went home, and he didn't live very far away, he lived about 45 minutes away, I said to her, you know what? I think it'd be really good if, it's way beyond the call of duty, you know, you're here to be a meditation teacher on this retreat, but I think it'd be really good if you went home and did a home visit to him. And see, you know, what his kid is like and how the family dynamics are. I think it'd be really great. This retreat and really connected to you as a teacher. I think since you have these skills, I think it'd be really good. And the other teachers who were teaching the retreat were aghast that I would suggest that. Because being a teacher on a retreat is a very high demand job. And it takes a lot of time, a lot of energy. And to drive 45 minutes to someone's home, do this kind of assessment, and then drive 45 minutes back was a big chunk of time in this kind of very intense kind of environment. So she said something like, you know, I'll think about it. And that was maybe, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning. And I thought to myself, oh, you know, I probably crossed some line asking her to do this, you know, and I shouldn't have done that. It was kind of putting pressure on her and all that. And I said, well, I don't know when she's going to... I thought about the schedule for the next week. I don't know when she's going to find time for this, you know. So I went to lunch, and she wasn't at lunch. And I asked, where is she? She said, oh, she went to see this guy. So when she came back, I said, what happened? And she said, you know, if I had to think about doing it, I probably never would have done it. So I just did it. The next first chance I had, I just called him and went, you know, at lunchtime, you know, a few hours later, and I went and did it. And she did it and came back, and it was kind of clean. She kind of didn't spend all this time wondering and thinking what she should do. There was this clean way of engaging and doing it. And she came back, and I don't know if, you know, if she was tired or exhausted her, but she then continued the rest of the retreat, and it was, as far as I could tell, it wasn't even a hiccup for her. And part of it, my guess, is that the fact that she did it so cleanly, this is what she did. She just got in her car and went over and took care of it and came back. So this thing about just doing, engagement. So this Zen thing, when you do something, you do it. And I remember in the monasteries in Japan, there's a variety of things connected to this, but I remember once carrying the pot of rice into the dining room for the evening meal. And, you know, so I was carrying the pot in one hand somehow. And I got reprimanded by the monks. When you carry a pot of rice, you carry it both hands. And because you engage yourself, you give yourself to this process of carrying the pot. You don't just kind of do it casually. Or when I was in the monastery, you know, it's a story I like to tell of how much I learned from cutting carrots. Carrots are my great spiritual teachers. Because when I was assigned to the kitchen to cut carrots, I didn't want to be there. And my posture showed that. And I was kind of like not really there, kind of like half my body was to the door. And in the Zen monastery, I learned a lot about being in my body and being present for what I was doing with my body. And so I turned my body around and engaged those carrots with everything that I had. And after a while, I thought, okay, let's do it again. It was a training to keep engaging myself in this thing with the carrots. Engagement. There's something really profoundly, well, maybe I shouldn't generalize based on myself, sorry. I was going to say something deeply satisfying about full engagement. Maybe it's not true for everyone. But what's so great about it, but to engage and kind of almost lose yourself in engagement where you kind of don't hold back. Holding back is no fun. I can say that safely as a generalization, isn't it? Generally, holding back is no fun. But to not hold back and give yourself to something is really great. And so it gives it kind of the joy, delight sometimes of activity, of what you're doing. And so when you sit down to meditate, can you engage in that kind of wholehearted way? So it's more than just kind of like, oh, you know, okay, I'm going to watch this little breath. Yes, here I am. I'm going to engage in this breath meditation. I'm going to engage in this practice with confidence, which is the first nourishing thing, but also with kind of energy, with effort, with yourself. Put yourself in it. You don't want to be kind of lightweight or kind of, you know, it's one thing to put it off for later. It's another thing to only give half of yourself or part of yourself to what you're going to do. But, okay, here I am. Some people, you know, maybe almost everyone, has trouble with meditation with their mind wandering away. Right? Sooner or later that happens. Your mind wanders off in thought. Sometimes the reason it wanders off in thought is because what you're doing, you're not doing it with effort, with energy, with engagement. You're only there kind of half-heartedly. So of course, if you're there half-heartedly, of course your mind's going to think about doing something else. Doesn't that make sense? So to not only give effort to your doing, but engagement with yourself. Here I am. So then the third nourishment is honesty. Honesty is such a deepening thing. Honesty feeds us. And what I'd like to recommend is you try it. Try it and see how honesty can feed you. How can you be on in such a way that it supports you and feeds you and nourishes you? Certainly, again, the lack of honesty, lying, is draining and tiring and stressful to kind of engage in the world of deceit. But to live a world of honesty brings a lightness, brings clarity, brings a lack. I would suggest the proper use of honesty reduces the amount of conflict we have in our life. So to find out how to use honesty as a way of reducing conflict, I think is one of the great things that nourishes us. I've seen over and over again the very act of speaking the truth, saying this is what's going on, settles something, clears the air, settles something. And the practice of mindfulness to me is a practice of telling the truth to yourself. So when you tell the truth, you kind of show up, you're here for something. You're kind of recognizing, really, it's like a full acknowledgement. This is what's happening, not avoiding that. So sometimes what you have to be honest about is aspects of yourself. Yes, I am scared. Yes, I am angry. Yes, I have no confidence. And I'm going to say that with confidence. Yes, there's no confidence here. I could say that for sure. And that changes the ecosystem to say that like that. Or I'm in pain. I'm in psychological pain. How many times in my life have I not been honest about my own pain? You know, seeing it in a heart, kind of know it's there, kind of in the background, but I'm not going to really notice it or pay attention to it. And then to turn around and say, yes, or, you know, I am in pain. That's what's really going on. Or to be in interpersonal situations and not really acknowledge to myself what's really going on. You know, I'm trying to impress this person. That's what's really going on. I'm trying to contort myself into some way so this person will like me. You know, that's what's going on. So to kind of name for yourself, be honest, really honest. What's really going on here? And what does it take to be honest? What kind of self-reflection, what kind of stopping, what kind of paying attention do you need so you can be really honest about what's going on with you? So I don't know if anybody's seen the newsletter that just came out, but in there, the opening sentences, it's something like, there is no Buddhist path without truth. So if you want to kind of deepen your Buddhist life, you do it through being honest. Being honest is sometimes difficult, sometimes often difficult. It's often difficult in interpersonal situations. So part of the engagement, the learning process, is to learn how to be honest in a way that is helpful, how to be honest in a way that works for everybody concerned. So then the third element is stability. Stability is very nourishing for meditation practice. And stability has many different forms. Some of them maybe are not doable by everybody. But I think having a regular life, a stable, regular pattern to your life is very helpful for a regular meditation practice. That's why in monasteries they have a set schedule. You know, you kind of, you know, by the minute where you're going to be sometimes in some monasteries. Everything's set. Every day you get up, it's the same routine, same routine. That repetition offers a kind of stability through the day. Retreats are like that we offer. There's very little variation in the course of the day in terms of the schedule. You sit, you do sitting meditation, you do walking meditation, you do sitting meditation, you do walking meditation, you do sitting meditation, and then you have your meal. And then after your meal, you have a break, and then guess what? You do sitting meditation and walking meditation, sitting, walking meditation. And so there's a regularity there. And that regularity helps stabilize the mind. You don't have to think about what you're going to do. You don't have to kind of be agitated about questions about what's next. You know what's next. So having stability is very helpful, regularity. Some of you who raise kids know how important that can be, to have a regular routine for the kids, the young kids, so that they can kind of get settled, be settled. Then there's a stability that comes from regularity of practice, to practice every day. I think if a person can, if their schedule allows it, to practice the same time every day. So there's that sense that the psyche, the mind, the body kind of expects it, knows it, it feels familiar. And so when you come to sit, there's stability there. There's a settledness that can happen because you know this is what you're doing. And then there's stability in the practice itself. So sitting with some kind of stability. I think anybody who meditates should spend some serious amount of time developing a good meditation posture, so that there's a physical stability when you sit. You can certainly meditate slouched in a couch. It's possible. But the chances are it's not going to be very deepening or very nourishing. It might be relieving. It might, you know, help if you're stressed a little bit. But it's only going to take you so far. But to take some time developing a good meditation posture. And sometimes it takes a while to learn that and sometimes or develop that. And it's, you have to sometimes work through a certain kind of discomfort. But to see, can you develop a place of being kind of... I like this idea of being a tripod. You know, three points as a firm base to hold us up. Even in a chair, you can get a firm foundation for your posture as you sit here. And then develop it such a way that your posture feels like your torso, your spine even, feels like it's balanced on top of itself a little bit. So you're not just kind of slouched over or bent over. Now, it's certainly possible to get enlightened bent over like this. People do it. In Burma, most men meditate like this. But I saw when I'm in Burma, they meditate like this. Now, it's possible. So, you know, if you want to do it that way, it's okay. But then you're not benefiting from the food, the nourishment of stability. And it's not very inspiring, even for yourself. In Burma, maybe I've told you this before, but in Burma, women, when they meditate, generally meditate like this. So one foot's behind them. Actually, when you listen to a Dharma talk in Burma, everyone's supposed to sit this way because it's more respectful. So, anyway, you don't have to. But you sit this way. But with this, it's very hard to slouch when you sit this way. So the women, when they meditate in Burma, they all sit up like this. And it's such a contrast between these guys and the women. The women sit with all this dignity and nobility. And one of the great sights of my life, which still nourishes me when I think about it, was when I was in the monastery in Burma, I would walk by the women's meditation hall. And literally, there were 500 women meditating in there. That's a lot of women, right? And they're all in rows, and because it's a warm climate, the two sides of the building were all open, completely open, so I can see the women from the side, these rows. And to see, it was a powerhouse. It was a spiritual powerhouse to see all these women sitting there straight and upright and very still and present. It was, you know, awesome. And then I walked by the men's meditation hall. So I think it's really good to have physical stability. And then to develop inner stability, stability of the mind. To cultivate a mind which doesn't waver or is not agitated. To have a mind that starts becoming still. So there's a lot of things that cultivate mental stability. One of them is to figure out how to overcome some of the regular ongoing conflicts in our life, or the conflicts with ourselves. Some of that has to do with doubting ourselves. That's why confidence is so important. It creates some stability. Some of that inner stability comes from regularity of practice in the meditation. To have one practice you do and just do it. I know some people will change their practices regularly. They'll follow their breath for a few minutes and they say, "Oh, that's not quite working so well. Maybe I'll do loving kindness meditation for a while." And they do that for a little while. That didn't work so well. Maybe if I count my breath. And then they do that for a while. And, well, maybe I'm following the breath in the wrong place. Maybe it should be in my nose rather than my belly. And they'll do that for a while. And they say, "Well, you know, this is not working. I've heard that doing nothing is a really good practice. Choiceless awareness. I'll just sit here and kind of be broad and spacious and equanimous and like a saint. That'd be really great." And they try that for 5 minutes. And then, you know, then they say, "This is tiring." And maybe fantasy is good for a while. Get a rest. So sometimes jumping around is not so good. Choosing one practice to do. It could, you know, not just for one period of meditation, but over a few months or a year is really good. Advice I give people when they come to me who are just beginning to become interested in a spiritual practice, like a Buddhist practice, meditation practice. And they might be interested in Zen, they might be interested in Vipassana, they might be interested in, you know, different kinds of Buddhism, and they can't decide between them. I'll tell them, "Well, if you can't decide, then flip a coin. Just doesn't really matter. Just choose one on some criteria, whatever makes it, some criteria allows you to make a choice. Maybe it's a meditation community that's close by, or maybe one that somehow you have affinity towards, or a friend of yours does, or something. Just choose one if you can't. You know, just flip a coin if you can't do anything else. And then do that one practice for a year. Because the basic work, inner development and change, that has to happen when you do meditation is really the same in the first year, regardless of what practice you do. If you do a mantra, you do your breath, you do loving kindness, you do visualization, you're still having to deal with your hindrances, your wandering mind, your inner conflicts, the kind of stuff, that kind of stuff of your life. It has to be sorted through. It doesn't really matter what practice you choose at first, because you just have to sort through the stuff. And then once you've sorted through it after a year or so, then you have a different kind of perception, different understanding. And then you can kind of look at the different traditions you're interested in, and through a deeper understanding, you can decide which one you want to do, which one suits you better or feels right. Make sense? So it doesn't matter what you choose. Choose one, and then by choosing one and staying with one, developing that stability, and working, stabilizing yourself, calming yourself, settling the mind, settling the heart. So to cultivate stability. And then the last one is deep understanding. And all the other four allow deep understanding to surface. So confidence, engagement, honesty, stability, all make it possible for us to see deeply, to be able to kind of penetrate what's really going on here. It's kind of like having a question. I know what's happening on the surface, but what's really happening here? If I'm still, if I listen deeply, if I penetrate, if I poke a little bit at what's really happening here in my life. You know, to look at the wandering mind, look at the mind that wanders off into thoughts all the time. What's that mind really about? Try to really understand that mind. Don't be in conflict with it. Don't keep pushing it away, running away from it, letting go of it. But if it keeps coming up over and over again and the mind wanders off, what's really going on there? Can you really understand that? So it might be, for example, that it keeps wandering off all the time because you're worried about something. And unless you really understand that you're worried and really engage in it, really look at it, that worry, the worry is going to keep prompting you to wander off into that kind of concern. Or perhaps it's the issue of lack of confidence or lack of real engagement. You're kind of half-hearted about it. To really understand that. What is it that needs to be understood here is a great question. Right now, now that I'm here to some degree, what is it about me, what is it about this present moment situation that really needs to be understood? I might not understand it yet, but what needs understanding? And then to begin understanding, to begin penetrating and discerning, having insight into our life, is a self-reinforcing, or is a reinforces the spiritual life, supports it, encourages it. We get our rewards then. We say, oh yeah, it's really good to have insight. It's good to understand. The more confidence we have, the more useful the insight is. The more insight we have, the more confidence we'll have. So five ways of nourishing your practice. So if nourishing your practice is something which is relevant for you, you might choose one of these five for a week or for a month and explore it and develop it. Look at confidence, understand how it works or doesn't work for you. Understand how it can be strengthened. What are the resources you have for tapping into confidence in yourself? What's your relationship to engagement? People have very different relationships to it. What's your relationship to engagement? And given who you are, what are the appropriate ways that you can be more fully engaged, more wholeheartedly engaged? What's your relationship to honesty? Later, please. What's your relation to honesty? What does it take for you to be really honest? One of the interesting ways of practicing honesty is to say something about yourself to someone else that you'd rather not want to say. Something true. And it could be a stranger. It could be something, you know, doesn't it? But what is it like to say something, to admit something to someone else that you kind of, you know it's true for yourself. But I think sometimes when you say it to someone else, it's a fuller acknowledgement. It kind of, the psyche somehow takes it in or is changed by it more fully. It's like no longer, like then you have to, then it's really owned up. You really owned it when you share it with someone else. And the bigger your personal challenge is, perhaps the more helpful it is to try to say it to someone else. This is my challenge. Don't keep it to yourself. It might help free you from it in some way. So what's your relationship to honesty? How can you practice it some more? What's your relationship to stability? How stable is your life? How stable is your mind? How stable is your heart? How stable is your body? What can you do to cultivate greater stability? And then what's your relationship to understanding? Are you interested in it? Do you have a questioning mind? Are you willing to question? Are you willing to kind of look and see what are the assumptions that are operating here? What are the emotions that are fueling how I behave? What is really happening here? Just ask that question. What's really happening here? And don't take the first answer as the answer. What's really happening here? And given this answer, then what's really happening? What's behind that? Develop understanding. So five nourishments. The Buddha called these five nourishments five capacities or five faculties that we each have. Meaning that these aren't things which are foreign to us. It isn't something you have to take from outside and bring in. These are all faculties, potentials that we all have. They're here. And it's possible to develop these faculties of ours to the point where they become strengths. So they're not just potentials, but they become something which is abiding with us, carrying with us, and becomes our personal strengths. And when they become our personal strengths, then they're there nourishing us, like wellsprings, bubbling up, feeding the spiritual life and spiritual engagement. So, five nourishments. Did you get them all? Anybody not remember all five? You got them? So we have a couple of minutes if anyone has any questions about that. The difference between engagement and clinging. Well, the difference. Well, there doesn't have to be a difference. But I guess the way I'm talking about engagement is that it's a healthy thing, skillful thing, wholesome. So it wouldn't be no clinging as part of it. Well, I think of clinging as being a contraction. There's tension when there's clinging. When there's engagement is clean. And there's effort, you know, that has to happen. But effort and tension are two different things. And it's possible to apply a tremendous amount of effort in something without having any tension as part of it, without any contraction or tightness. So even if a person can put a lot of effort into something, sometimes people give more effort into something because there's clinging. You know, and it looks on the outside like there's even more engagement because there's so much desire, there's so much clinging desire, ambition or something. But I think if you pay attention inside, what it feels like to engage that way, you'll see very quickly that there's tension, contraction, suffering as part of that. That's my thought. What do you think?
Well, for me, it's hard to see the line.
So sometimes our engagement has something unhealthy as part of it. There might be intentions which are unhealthy, or there might be expectations or clinging to results or something. And one of the great things is if you do mindfulness practice, so you're paying attention to what's going on, what's happening, or let me say it differently. Some things you only learn by engaging in it. If you think, oh, I don't think I should do this because I think there's some clinging here, so I don't think I'll try, you might never really find out. But some things, if you engage in it really fully, then the weak links will show themselves sooner or later. So I've seen that from my own meditation practice. When I was kind of relatively new to all this, that I had certain intentions, certain motivations or ways of practicing which weren't very healthy. Like I was attached to getting concentrated. That's really what's important. I got to get concentrated. And so when I practiced every day at home, that intention to get concentrated, that attachment to concentration, wasn't a problem because I was so frazzled in my daily life that in fact I did get a little bit more concentrated. It wasn't dramatic. It wasn't even my doing. I would just unwind a little bit and then I'd take credit for it. No, look, I'm getting concentrated. This is good. And then I'd go and retreat with that same intention. Oh, it's up to me. I got to do this and I'm going to get concentrated. And I would unwind the first day or so, take credit for it. And then the second or third day, you know, I was this attachment to getting concentrated, and it just wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. I couldn't do it. That was kind of self-defeating approach to practice. And so then I saw it, and it was very painful. And eventually I realized, oh, I'm attached here. I have to let go of it. So as long as I kind of engaged only a little bit, 45 minutes a day, I couldn't see the attachment. But by engaging more fully, then the weak link showed itself. So what I'm trying to say is sometimes don't worry about the attachment. Engage and then learn from what happens. Learn from the engagement. Sometimes that works really well. If you're unsure. So I know most people, I think, have some kind of strange intention or motivation connected to meditation practice when they first start. I wouldn't worry about it. It's fine. And it all worked itself out over time. You know. So, thank you. And in giving this talk, my hope was to give you a little bit of nourishment. And if this talk didn't nourish you, then at least I told you how to get nourished. So thank you.